Good evening. Welcome to Viterbo University. Our talk tonight is a keynote address for a conference we are having on temperance. This is the third of a series of four conferences we're having on the topic of the cardinal virtues. And to start us off this evening, I'd like to ask Tom Thibodeau, who's chair of the Department of Religious Studies here at Viterbo University and one of our conference presenters tomorrow, to lead us off with a prayer. Tom?
A prayer from that most temperate saint, Saint Francis. Grant your servants, O God, to be set on fire with your spirit, strengthened by your power, illuminated by your splendor, filled with your grace to go forward with your aid. Give us, O Lord, a right faith, perfect love, true humility. Grant, O Lord, that there may be in us a simple affection, brave patience, persevering obedience, perpetual peace, a pure mind, a right and clear heart, a good will, a holy conscience, spiritual compunction, spiritual strength, a life unspotted and upright, and after finishing our course, may we be happily enabled to enter into your kingdom together. Amen.
Thank you, Tom. A couple of notes as we get started this evening. First of all, you will notice there's a survey inside of your the program for tonight. We'd really appreciate it if you'd fill that out and indicate if you'd like to be on our mailing list. Let us know how you heard about this event. And if you have any comments about this event tonight, just write those on the back. And you can hand them to the ushers at either side as you leave tonight, or if you find any flat spot, you know, on your way out, just lay it there. Somebody will pick it up, and we appreciate that. Also, there will be a reception following the talk tonight in the lobby, just out the door and to your left or right as you go out. We'll also have books available by our speaker, Put Your Life on a Diet. And the books will be $10 a piece. And he also has some more information about some of the things he'll be talking about available for you there. As I mentioned, this is the keynote address for our conference on the virtues. And when we started this series 3 years ago, we started with the virtue of justice and then went on to courage, because I thought it would be fairly easy to find people who would come to present on a conference on justice and another conference on courage, and fairly easy to find keynote speakers who could talk about those subjects. But when we got to temperance, I was a little bit worried. Are we going to find anybody who's even going to want to come to a conference on temperance? What happened is we were overwhelmed with submissions for the conference. We ended up accepting 27 papers. Total, we've got 27 presenters from 24 different colleges and universities across the nation and from 15 states. And so thank you to those of you who are here tonight who are participating in this conference, who never thought that this would be the something that would really draw people. The other challenge of doing a conference on temperance is finding a keynote speaker, because part of the keynote speaker's job is to talk about a virtue in a way that a general audience can understand, not just something that academics are going to be drawn to. And temperance is a word that we don't use much in our society. We use synonyms sometimes, words like self-control or moderation. But even there, it's hardly a really engaging topic that you're going to find people coming to hear a lecture on a Thursday evening about moderation or self-control. But we were able to find somebody who's done some interesting thinking and some interesting practical work on this topic of temperance. And I first heard of Gregory Paul Johnson last year. I was one June afternoon, I was browsing the internet trying to find somebody after talking to people and not being able to find somebody you thought would be a good person to talk on this, came across reference to this book, Put Your Life on a Diet. And it mentioned that the author was going to be speaking and selling books at the release date of this book at the Prairie Lights Bookstore in Cedar Rapids. So I drove down to Cedar Rapids the next day and sat in the audience, and I learned something really interesting. First of all, he had this little tiny house sitting outside the bookstore. And a little house the size of an efficiency apartment that you're going to be seeing some pictures of, which was really compelling. But the other thing is, when we tend to think of temperance in our society now, many of us tend to think of this as an old virtue. We maybe think of hermits or monks somewhere living a life of real simplicity. What I learned from Gregory Paul Johnson was his temperate lifestyle was really high-tech. And I didn't expect that. And I think it's one of the interesting lessons that society keeps changing. Ways of doing things change. But there are certain virtues, certain things that we want to achieve, maybe using many different methods to achieve it. And those things are lasting. And that's one of the aims of this conference on the virtues, is to look at what is it about our human life that is lasting. Gregory Paul Johnson, really an interesting person, a great writer, but a person who's developed this wonderful website, Resources for Life, that I really encourage you to look at. And I think you're going to be delighted by the talk this evening. Please welcome Gregory Paul Johnson.
Thank you, Rick. It's great to be here. I drove up from Iowa City, from the University of Iowa, where I work, drove up yesterday, and I haven't been in Wisconsin for a number of years, but it was good to get back here and drive through all those rolling hills and on into the night hours. I had to use my little GPS system to navigate. Made a couple of wrong turns on the way, but finally got here. So anyway, Iowa City is much like La Crosse, you know, a community enriched by academics and education. When you have an institution like this, there are opportunities to come out and listen to speakers and certainly get education and that type of thing. So it's a wonderful thing being in a college community. The title of my talk tonight is Temperance is the New Black. And you'll notice I'm wearing black. I was trying to explain this title to my dad, and he said, "Well, I don't understand. I don't get it. What is it, the new black?" And so I explained that, you know, that black is, as a color, something that, whether it's a car or something you're wearing, it kind of fits in at any occasion. You could be going to a wedding, a funeral, a special event, or whatever, black fits in. You could even be a stagehand, you know. They wear black. So black is something that fits with anything. And it's sort of timeless, you know, you've seen kind of black as a style throughout the ages. Well, temperance also kind of fits in with anything, and it's timeless. We can look back over history, thousands of years, and we see this theme of temperance consistently being there. There are some other themes that I won't touch on tonight, but Rick mentioned, you know, the virtues. People that give some time to studying the scriptures, to the Bible, and applying that to their lives in real practical ways, find that these are many of the principles taught in the Bible are principles of effective living. You know, we think about temperance and virtues and these things in the context of morality, and that's important. And the prayer that was thoughtfully read earlier from St. Francis ended with this thought of us going to heaven, so that, you know, these virtues are a way of preparing our soul, preparing our life for entering into heaven. But, you know, there's another advantage of living a temperate life, of living a life of temperance, and of living a life of pursuing God and these principles. The other benefit is just a more effective and a more enjoyable life. So that's a little bit of what I'm going to be talking about. Let me get a little controller here. Let's see. Universal remote. If I can only work it. Let's see. It works. Okay. So as Rick mentioned, I have a book, Put Your Life on a Diet, Lessons Learned Living in 140 Square Feet. That title comes from the past 5 years, since August of 2003, living in a house that is 10 by 7 in size. It's two stories, so 140 square feet. And there are quite a few lessons that I learned throughout this experience. The construction of the home was really the culmination of a lot of thought and that went into how would I design it. And I contracted with Jay Schaefer of the Tumbleweed Tiny House Company, who built the house, and I assisted in the construction. But one aspect of the house that I think is very important and essential with today's concerns about the environment and green living is that it is a very airtight home. And I'm going to be comparing and contrasting that with the life of temperance. But anyway, I guess I want to back up a little bit and talk about this comparison between the house, your home, my home, and how when you live more effectively in the home that you have, it can make it feel more spacious. A lot of people read my book and they say, well, you know, I'm not going to go and live in a 10 by 7 house, but we do want to make our current home more comfortable, more open, more spacious. And these principles of putting your life on a diet can do that. And similarly, living a life of temperance, you know, if you look at your life as though your life is a home, living a life of temperance can make your entire life feel more spacious, organized, effective, planned, and controlled by you rather than being controlled by it. Now, many of us do not have a well-planned life. You know, life happens to us. We're kind of reacting to circumstances and situations, things you didn't plan on. And much the same as when I was an undergraduate, I studied urban and regional planning. And there are some communities that are very well-planned. There's a master plan, and they're planned out over a period of years, and they know where the industrial area is going to be and where the homes are going to be, and maybe there's some mixed urban space. So that's all planned out. And when you go visit a community like that, you can tell that somebody really gave that a lot of thought. But many communities just don't have the advantage of that. You know, there's a factory goes up here, an apartment building there, and there's some zoning, but it doesn't quite look like there's an overall plan. So similarly, with a person's life, if you can take a moment, take some time aside, a weekend, to think about where is your life, where has it been, where is it going, and start planning your life as if you were planning a city or planning to build a home, planning your life that way, it can just be, your life can be designed a little more efficiently, effectively, and better serving your interests. Now let me give you some principles. I want to share some principles of how to really practically bring this down to everyday life, okay? Living more effectively, applying some principles of temperance and restraint and cutting back, at the same time, increasing your quality of life. So here's just a simple example. Let's say you can afford to buy an inexpensive car, and I mean like a $1,000 car. You know, I'm going to talk to some people here that are on that low budget. You're not going to go out and get the $20,000 vehicle. You've got maybe $1,000. You'd be better off, And this is just an example, but you'd be better off buying an expensive bicycle. So get a bicycle of very high quality rather than a car of very poor quality. Start making that kind of a decision with everything in your life. So, for example, let's say you have $200. You could get an old computer that's kind of filled with viruses and it's going to need a lot of work. It's going to break down on you. Or maybe you just go out and get an iPhone, and that will let you surf the web, do your email, that type of thing. So it's a very nice portable device instead of a very poor desktop computer. You can make up some of your own examples as well, but the idea is to make your life simpler, smaller, and make choices toward higher quality of living rather than quantity. Okay. And then some people have said, you know, I'd rather have a few quality relationships than have, you know, on Facebook, 10,000 friends on Facebook. You know, how well do you know those 10,000 people? So that's the point. Less is more, at least more quality. So I'm going to talk about the book, Put Your Life on a Diet. What is life? What is our life experience, and how would we put that on a diet? Well, on the resourcesforlife.com website, you'll find a link at the top of the page for MAP, And it's kind of a map of the website, but it's also a map of what's life about. What are the areas of life that we spend time and money and energy on? Okay, so and our experiences in life generally, I don't like to give absolutes, but you know, generally fall into about seven main categories, and those are listed on that page. You can see life ways, which is a person's own personal adoption of a religion, or could be philosophy if somebody's not found a religion that fits their life. But life ways is sort of your overall outlook on life. And then health. Health, for many people, what you eat, your exercise, your sleep, all of those things that go into health, that's a big piece of the pie of what life is about. And you'll notice if you're looking at this, can everyone see that pie chart pretty well? Raise your hand if you can't see it. Okay, I'll just keep describing then what's on the pie chart. Going from clockwise, from you know, from the right, going around, the pie chart breaks up these different areas of life. And the idea is that these areas of life are increasingly interdependent. So let me explain that. Before we can get motivated, let's say, to go to the gym and exercise and eat some healthy food, we have to kind of start back a little bit with some having some purpose in life, some meaning in life. For many people, that is, you know, having a connection with God and having a religious life. But before you can get motivated to go out and do all these other things, you kind of have to start there. And the next step, I would say, is health. Because without health, if you don't take care of your health, then these other areas of life are going to be compromised pretty quickly, right? As much as you love your family, if you smoke and drink and don't take care of your health, pretty soon you're going to be dependent on them rather than you helping them. The story is told of the child that grows up, and when the child's young, you know, says, "I need you," to the parents, you know, and then reaches a certain age when the child says, "No, I don't need you," you know, maybe that's teenage years. And then eventually, though, the child wants to come back and say, you know, "How can I serve you?" to the parents. So it's that full circle. So anyway, you need good health to reach that level of maturity where you say, okay, it's not about what can I get from my parents or what can I get from my country or whatever. It's what can I do for others. And so you need good health for that. And the next step in this evolving interdependent wheel or pie chart is career. It's good to have a vocation, you know. And so you're, through your career, that takes you to the next stage or phase here, which is finance. And these are all happening at the same time. But keep in mind, you can't have a healthy financial situation if you don't have, either you're an entrepreneur or you've gone to a, you know, technical vocational college, or you have some sort of skill in the job market that allows you to grow in maturity in that area of your life, your vocation, so that you can have financial responsibility. And then the next area is relationships. Now, many people would say, well, wait a minute, you know, relationships, my family, my spouse or children, that's the number one priority. How did that get behind, you know, health, going to the gym or going to work? You might recall on the airplane, as I think most people have probably flown at one time or another or seen this demonstration where at the beginning of the flight, the flight attendant says, you know, if there's a loss of pressure in the cabin, there's loss of cabin pressure, the oxygen mask will come down. And they have to remind people, particularly the parents, they say, put the mask on yourself first and then, you know, fumble around with putting those masks on your kids, which is very important. But the reason they tell you that is because your instinct, especially any of you here who have an instinct to be giving and serving, if you have a servant's heart, you know, your instinct is to put everyone else above yourself, which is good. Hold on to that. Build that up. That's a good thing. Jesus said, you know, I came to serve, not to be served. I mean, that's having a servant's heart is a good thing. But remember the lesson of the oxygen mask. You know, there's a scripture that says, don't muzzle the ox. You know, the ox that works, that treads out the grain, you know, it needs food. It needs strength. You do too, you know. So you've got to put that oxygen mask on. And that's why these other categories come first. It's all a matter of perspective. Are you getting, you know, healthy and fit because you want to look toned, because you want to, you know, make it easy to find men or women or whatever your case may be, you know, person of the opposite sex, you know, is that your intention? Is the career and money, is that so you can just go out and spend money on yourself? Well, then that's not quite right. But if your heart is in the right place and you're thinking about, you know, not muzzling the ox, you know, your heart's in the right place, you're strengthening yourself, you're equipping yourself, you're empowering yourself for the purpose of serving other people. The same diagram in the proper perspective. Okay, so that's why relationships fit in there. And then beyond relationships, we can look at areas of life like activism, taking some time out of your schedule to go help others, volunteer at a soup kitchen, whatever it might be. But you know something, I've met some people who are so passionate about their calling in life. And there's some serious things that need to be done, you know, environmental concerns, healthcare concerns, political concerns, all kinds of concerns, and they're valid. But if you become too passionate about that calling in your life, that it starts to detract from, and this can happen, you know, just detract from your family, from your spouse and kids. Oh, yeah, honey, it's, you know, it's going to be another late night. You know, this is also important, this work at the office. Well, pretty soon, all that work at the office or whatever it is you're doing is going to impact your health. It's going to impact your relationships. You're going to have less time for your inner self, you know. So there has to be balance. And that's where that, you know, that activism needs to be held under constraint. And if you start noticing that your relationships are strained, then ask yourself, you know, am I going a little bit too overboard on my desire to reach out and change the world, make the world a better place? And then finally, the last area that I highlight here is effectiveness. So most of the areas of life, things that we interact with and do, fall into one of these categories. But there are some things, there are a few special things that fall into this area of effectiveness that affect every area of life, you know? And temperance is one of those things. You'll find that if you build up, I refer to it as something that's almost like a muscle in your body. You know, you go to the gym and you work out your upper body, you work out your lower body. For your upper body, you have your biceps and your triceps, and you're working on these different muscle groups. There is, and I won't cover it tonight, but there is a whole muscular structure to the spiritual man or woman. Okay, there's a whole muscular structure there. There's food. The Bible talks about the clothing, you know, put on the full armor of God. There are references to our spiritual clothing, our spiritual weapons, but they're weapons of essentially tools of kindness and love. And so there is spiritual food. There's a whole spiritual element there. And so temperance is like one of these muscles in the body. And you can train it. You can become more self-controlled. You can become more disciplined. You can have more restraint, not for the purpose of punishing yourself, but for the purpose of enjoying life more, for the purpose of being more effective at life. So anyway, I wanted to touch on that big picture a little bit because I'm going to quickly zoom in and talk about how temperance fits into all of this. One aspect of temperance is this idea of cutting back on things. And I had a time in my life where I had a lot of things, a lot of stuff. And it takes up space, it takes up time, it kind of takes up money. You have to sort of maintain and dust all these things. And I had an opportunity to look back and think, what if I had it to do all over again? And it was kind of a turning point in my life where I decided, you know, I am going to, as I described earlier, have a life that is planned out. Have as much as possible. Obviously, it's up to God what happens. But, you know, as much as is our responsibility, be responsible. Take the initiative to have a life that's planned out. And so I started thinking about, you know, what would my house look like? If I had the ideal home, what would it be? And it made me realize that I was happiest when I had nothing. And as I thought about that phrase, I thought, you know, that's really interesting. Why do we refer to having nothing? You can't have nothing. Nothing is like that's the state of not having anything, right? And then there's this scripture that's similarly interesting. You still lack one thing. Sell everything you have and give it to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven. Then come follow me. So here, Jesus was talking about lacking, being without what he goes on to describe. Nothing. You know, this idea that there is some value in reaching a point in life where you have very little stuff. And growing up, my dad made a point of introducing me to a lot of different people. Everybody from different political views, religious views, economic backgrounds. And I had a chance to meet some very wealthy people. And I don't mean, you know, middle class wealthy people. I mean like people that lived in castles and stuff. And all of these encounters had an impression on me, but particularly these wealthy people, because the people I knew who were rich weren't really rich. You know, I mean, they had their credit cards, and they'd go out with these credit cards, and they'd buy up all the clothes and the material things to make it look like they were rich. They would buy the big house. They couldn't afford that. The bank owns the house. They're just making payments. So the fancy car, the big house, all of the fancy clothes, all of that to impress others, maybe to make themselves think that they're wealthy, but they weren't. And the truly wealthy people then, when I met them, their cars, 10, 20 years old, old vehicles. Their clothing, maybe from Goodwill. Seriously. And I thought, that just doesn't make sense. I thought, you know, if somebody had like a lot of money, they'd be buying all, you know, the yachts and the cars. Like you hear some of these multi-level marketing programs. You know, you go to the big event and the person shows you their Cadillac and their big home and all that. But these truly wealthy people had an insight. You know, if they needed something, I guess they could go get it. You know, they'd go rent it. A lot of these folks didn't even own cars. I know someone living in New York City rides a bicycle, could afford a car. But what these people have discovered, these wealthy people, is that things are cumbersome. And also things don't make you wealthy. In fact, for most people, things make you poor. And not just financially. You know, they kind of just weigh your life down. So it's a good practice to ask yourself, do I really need this stuff? There's a store on my website, on the resourcesforlife.com website. And if you click on store, you'll see there's sort of a disclaimer. It says, wait a minute, don't go shopping yet. And then there's this long list. You can click on this long list of things. And it says, do you really need this? Okay, if you need it, do you need it now? Can it wait? Do you think maybe you could borrow it? Can you rent it? Can you buy it locally? There's this long list trying to discourage you from buying at my online store. And I'm happy to say sales have declined. That's my goal. I'll find some other way to make money, you know. But sales haven't disappeared. People still need stuff, but they're thoughtful about it now, you know. There's just a number of suggestions there, actually. That would be a tip for you, is to go there and read those suggestions and think about that. So anyway, having nothing. And now, I mentioned earlier, and I want to go into it a little more, the idea of having an airtight home. In constructing a home, a new home, you have the freedom to really make it airtight. Now, of course, you need oxygen to live. But when the home is airtight, you control the flow of air in that home. Okay? And I'm making a comparison here then, saying that in a life of temperance, that's kind of like having an airtight home. It's not that you're never going to eat food again, or never going to do something you enjoy again. It's that you're tightening it up. You're in control of it. There are people who are asked, you know, why do you use the toothpaste that you use? Well, I don't know. I guess it's my favorite toothpaste. This is a story I've heard of somebody who was asked about this. And it turned out that person, after a lengthy inquiry, it turned out, well, you know what? Yeah, it's because of that advertisement I saw on TV. They were, you know, the decisions in many people's lives are not because they thought it through. It's just because they kind of reacted to something in the media. So by having a life of temperance, it's really a life where you're controlling the decision process. And if you have a drafty home, you know, it's very inefficient, it's expensive to heat, a life without temperance is kind of like that. You know, things just kind of flow in and flow out, and maybe there's some habits that aren't even very good that you're not on top of, and so you're wasting time, wasting money, wasting energy. And so you can think about your home and compare it to how a home is, how your life is also structured. Now I'm going to mention a few scriptures that St. Paul gives us regarding temperance. And I mentioned here, I just learned today, that from June 2008 to June 2009, there is the year of St. Paul here in La Crosse. Some of the churches are sponsoring events to look at different aspects of the life of Paul. So I thought I'd mention that. If you can attend one of those, you probably would enjoy it. Paul is one of my favorite teachers of course, religion and Christianity, and he, in many ways, founded much of what today is Christianity. But also, I really see Paul as a motivational, persuasive speaker and an effectiveness trainer by necessity. I say by necessity because he had to be effective. He didn't have a lot of resources. He was paddling upstream. And so Paul is a wonderful example, you know, as we look at his life and his teachings, of somebody who was very on target with how do we make relationships. He was building the church. How do we make organizations effective? And how does he help people's lives become effective? Okay. So here are just a few scriptures that Paul offers us. And the first one I have there is, I think, maybe one of the more important ones. It's kind of like, what is all this about? Why are we wanting to be effective? Well, Paul explains. To prepare, or in the King James, equipping the saints, he says, to prepare God's people for works of service so that the body of Christ may be built up. Now, you may not be involved in full-time ministry or even be that active in a church, but the principle is the same. The principle is that you want to prepare your life for works of service. And you'll remember the slide that was up earlier, that pie chart. Works of service falls into that activism area of life, you know. And certainly, you want to prepare yourself for serving your family and your coworkers and serving the world around you. Rather than being a taker, you strengthen yourself and get an education, and then you can be a giver. You're producing more than you're taking. That's the goal of countries as well. You know, you want to have a positive trade exchange with other countries. You don't want to be constantly maintaining a negative trade deficit. That's how you go into debt as a country. So as an individual, it's the same. As best as possible, you want to be giving out more than you're taking in. And here's another scripture I really like from Paul. Let us throw off everything that hinders. Now, he was talking about sin and some things that just complicate life. But the principle is the same. Things. You know, if you have things, if your garage is filled up with things and your basement is filled up with things and there's not even room in the garage to park the car, so the car's parked outside, you know, those things are starting to hinder you. I mean, you know, hinder your ability to enjoy life. So that's, I think, an important message that Paul was sharing. And then this next scripture from 1 Corinthians 6:12 is very interesting. Paul says, everything is permissible for me, but not everything is beneficial. And it's very interesting coming from Paul, because Paul's background, you may know, was he was trained, raised up as a Jew. You know, so he would be familiar with these 613 laws in Judaism. You know, and if you're coming from that background, you know, not everything is permissible. There's this long list of stuff that's not permissible. So what's he talking about? Well, this is as a Christian. You know, he's talking about life as a Christian, that there isn't the rigidity. But at the same time, he says, even though these things are permissible, it's not beneficial. And I really gravitate toward that teaching. And there's probably a whole book behind that. But the simplest of the message is that, you know, we often think of these virtues. We think of temperance. We think of the Bible and religion. And I don't know, that's kind of like God pushing a bunch of laws on us. And why doesn't he just leave us alone, you know, with all these laws? Well, you know, what Paul's saying is this isn't about, it's not about laws and what you can do and what you can't do and what's permissible and not permissible. For a moment, just think about what's beneficial. And you'll see there's an alignment there. You know, it's not that God wants you to be suffering and the Bible's all about these laws and things. It's more that the Bible sets out some principles that Paul's talking about and the virtues that we're talking about. These are just principles to live a better life. That's all. Just to enjoy yourself. You know, you're going to enjoy yourself if you avoid some of life's pitfalls. That's all. It's sort of like your parents. You know, when you're growing up, some of you still are, you know, there's kind of this rebellion. You know, it's like, I don't want to listen to you, Mom, Dad. I've heard enough of that. You know, and then a little ways along and you're in your mid-20s, your 30s, and then you're thinking, oh, that made some sense. You know? So the same thing's true with the Bible, is there's that maturing. You know, at first you might be fighting it and thinking, oh, I don't want to deal with that. And then later on you start thinking about it. There's no more of that peer pressure or whatever. You just have some time on your own. You're reading it through. You're thinking about it. And that kind of makes some sense, you know. I learned the hard way or something. So, anyway. And this final verse from Paul, 2 Corinthians 6:9, poor, and this is in a long list of things, beaten but not killed. He's talking about these extremes that he's going through and yet surviving it all. And this concludes with poor, yet making many rich, having nothing, and yet possessing everything. And many of us think, you know, if we're poor, it's a position of weakness. And when I say poor, I mean poor in things, lacking in a lot of stuff. But Paul's saying, no, you're empowered by being, I'll put it in quotes, poor. It's empowering. And by having nothing, you sort of possess everything. And the point is there that it's not so much that you own everything, but it's that you, for example, going back to these wealthy people I talked about, they don't try to own all this stuff, you know? And I learned this principle too, touching on this last scripture. Think about this. Let's say in the morning, and up here in La Crosse in the winter, the snow, the ice, you get up, you've got to go start your car, right? And you're not just going to start your car and drive away because there's like this much ice on it. So you should probably warm it up for half an hour and maybe get it scraped off. What if you could pay somebody to come over and scrape that ice off the car? And since they're already there and you have some things to work on, you could just say, hey, since you're already here and I paid you $5, can you just drive the car for me? And then I don't have to drive. I can read my book and do some other things. And you get to work, and you tell this person, you say, well, you know, I paid you that $5, and you came over, you started my car, you scraped the ice off, you know, I really appreciate that, and you drove me to work. It's really hard to find parking. Can you go just find a parking spot for me and plug the meter all day? Do you mind doing that? And, you know, the $5 is yours. And then, you know what, at the end of the day, if you can just kind of keep yourself free, because at some point I'm going to be calling you, and you can come back and pick me up, and I'm just going to give you $5 for the whole day. How's that sound? Well, that doesn't sound like a very good deal for them. But I mean, for you, wouldn't you rather just spend $5 and have all that stuff taken care of? Well, I don't know if there's a taxi cab service here in La Crosse, is there? Okay. And in Iowa City, college town, lots of taxi cabs. Well, I figured this out the other day. You give a $5 bill to a taxi driver, and you don't have the hassles of scraping the ice. And I didn't even mention paying for maintenance. And the car payments, and the insurance, and the license, taxes, all that. And you don't have to drive. And another way of looking at it is, imagine this like multi-million dollar vehicle that's voice controlled. You just speak to it and it goes. Well, that's kind of what a taxi cab is. So it's not surprising that many wealthy people don't even bother with cars. A car is the depreciating asset. You buy a car for, you know, $30,000, that thing is losing value. You know, nobody with a business mindset is going to buy a car. You rent a car. I came up here, rented a car, $18 a day. $18. I think I'll go with the rental car. I mean, it's a 2008 brand new. There's no way I could get that for $18 from a dealership, you know. So what happens then as you, connecting with Paul's teaching, accept this, embrace this idea of having nothing yet possessing everything, possessing access to just about anything, your life becomes richer. You become wealthy by living like those who are wealthy. So I'll move on. And connecting with this car getting to work analogy, and I'm going to talk a little bit about homes as well. Why do we so often see an individual driving a car that could accommodate 4 to 6 adults? I ride my bike to work just about every day, probably 350 days out of the year or something. I ride the bike, and I notice people driving these big vehicles, and it's just one person in there, you know? Now, some of these environmentalists have kind of gone overboard. In Chicago, they were lighting these on fire with gasoline and burning them up. I'm not sure, you know, if that's going to get a lot of converts to their cause. But, you know, there is a concern, though. It's like, that's not very effective and efficient to be driving such a big vehicle for just one person. It only gets maybe, you know, 15 to 20 miles a gallon. Well, I don't want to think critical of somebody that drives an SUV. And I think, you know, it makes sense because this person, it's their money. They obviously would have spent it wisely, you know, and they thought through, well, you know, every once in a while we get together with the family and there might be 5 or 6 of us in the car. And then, you know, summertime, pulling the camper, and there's the boat and the jet skis, and sometimes I need to do some snow plowing and stuff like that. So, yeah, I need that, you know, and that's how the guy convinces himself to buy this $35,000, $40,000 truck, you know. Well, similarly, when somebody's living in a large home, I have some friends. It was just one, and now he's married, so there are two of them. But it was him living in 4,000 square feet. And it's a two-bedroom home with 4,000 square feet. Now, that's twice the size of most homes. The average is about 2,400 square feet. But why does that happen? Why do you see, you know, one or two people buying a home with 4 rooms, 5 rooms, large homes? Well, so that we're not critical of somebody like that, you know, you think through, what would they have asked themselves? They may have children coming home to stay for Christmas time, something like that. They might want to entertain. They might want to have family over at Thanksgiving time. So you need a big home for that. Well, what if we started thinking about, and keep in mind, these are just little teeny nuggets that I'm sharing with you, little nuggets, and it's to get you thinking in a certain way that applies to all these other areas of life. Okay, so I'm just giving you some examples, and you can start thinking through some other areas of life as well. What if, when thinking about buying a home or a vehicle, we thought about what would meet 90% of my need, you know? 90% of your need, well, that could be, 90% of your need could probably be for transportation, maybe a bicycle or a tiny electric car. Here's an example of one. And, you know, similarly with a home. Okay, maybe you have 5 kids and they all come home at Thanksgiving. But 364 days out of the year, it's just you, you know? So if we start to think in terms of what serves 90% of our need, that can make a big difference in our life. And I mentioned the example of taxi cabs. So let's move forward. And I'm going to be relating this story of mine of living in the tiny house, and I'll be looking. We'll have some pictures here in just a second. But talking a little bit about the things, I think some of you I've spoken with already who've read my book, and some of you are here for that purpose. And so I'm going to connect with that idea and temperance. So because temperance, really, in fact, any of the virtues and any of the principles in the Bible, these teachings from Paul. Of what value is it, you know, and I don't want to minimize it. Certainly there's an internal value. But it's really important, I think, and it's possible, to connect them to our real day-to-day life, you know? So let's do that, right? The space we need. In a home, if you're going to be buying a home, and everybody's familiar with the housing crisis and the need to probably buy well within your budget or rent, well within your budget, have a lot of breathing room. You know, most people in the U.S. are living on 110% of what they earn. That means they're going into debt every month. It's on a credit card, it's with the second mortgage. So it's very important to set a lifestyle for yourself that's not overextended financially. Well, how do we determine how much space we need? Exercise is important. There should probably be some room in your house for a treadmill or some weights or something. Because you're probably not going to get exercise on the job. Most people don't. You know, times have changed. You're not going to work out in the field as one might have, you know, 100, 200 years ago. Sleeping, we all need sleep. There's got to be a bedroom. Hygiene is important, so there needs to be a bathroom, shower, some laundry facility, keeping things clean. Food storage, you have to eat. It's got to be a place for food. There needs to be a place to prepare the food. Cooking. Food consumption. The food's been cooked. Now you need to eat it. There needs to be a dining room. Most people are either in school, so you're studying at home in your dorm room or wherever, so you need a place to study. Or if you have a full-time job, there are many people now that are entrepreneurs on the side. You have a small business, crafts, some kind of service that you run out of your home and benefit on your taxes for doing that. So you have some place at home that's your workplace. And socializing, you got to socialize, got to get out and socialize with people. So there needs to be a family room. And then when you're not socializing, there's an entertainment room, with a big screen TV. So which one of these areas of life would you want to do without? None of them. You can't stop eating. You can't stop sleeping. You can't stop, doing these things. So these are essential. And that essentially then dictates the size of your home. I said the average home is about 2,400 square feet. Here is a floor plan of a 2,000 square foot home. This is, in fact, the home that I was living in up to the year 2000. I was living in a 2,000 square foot home. And I was making use of every room in that house. I'm just going to go up to the screen here. And, I'll just point from left to right. I'm going to go clockwise. There's the bedroom in the upper left corner. And then a bathroom next to that. And then a dining room. And then to the right of that is a kitchen. And beyond the kitchen is a utility area and a pantry for storing food and doing the laundry. And then the furthest corner there is the master bathroom. And then going from left to right on the bottom here is another bedroom. You can see some closets. And then a large living room. And then the master bedroom. So pretty modest home, really. And smaller than the national average. Okay? And you can see each room corresponds to what I was showing you previously, this list of things that we all need to do, and there's a room, a room for everything and everything in its room, right? So here's some pictures from that home inside, nice solid wood finished cabinets and kitchen area, and very comfortable fireplace, big living room, desk area you can see there. And these slides, by the way, I'm going to plan to put these online. So if I'm skipping through things and you want to go back and read over it, that'll be there. And I'm going to make another announcement at the end. But I'll have some things on the web, including an interactive online forum and an audio recording of this presentation and some other resources that you can connect to. So anyway, just more pictures. The master bathroom with a large bathtub there and the washer-dryer. And so that home, I'll just skip back a little bit here. The 2,000 square foot home is generally nestled into this, suburbia culture. And what you see in this slide, in this picture here, this actually was taken, I had gone with my sister to Des Moines, Iowa, and went on a balloon ride. I'm going to get some water. Hold on just a moment. I'm going to lose my voice here. So I went to visit my sister. She's in Des Moines. I went there. And she always wanted to go on a balloon ride. Well, she finally convinced me to go. I didn't want to go. It doesn't seem like a smart idea. The one I went in, it's like, have you ever been on one of those roller coasters that's like the old-fashioned kind that sort of creaks and squeaks and you feel like the thing's just going to fall apart on you? So we went ballooning with these people that were, the ballooning traditionalists, They had this, looked like 200-year-old basket thing. Wicker basket. I mean, I wouldn't even put a kitten in there. And so it's my sister and me and then this guy that's doing the ballooning. And, it's like the last minute. I mean, we'd get there. And he says, well, there's a little bit of training. First of all, these really hot flames, you want to stay away from those. They're going to be right above your head. So anyway, we get all the training down and lift off in this balloon. And it's kind of scary because you're just like looking over the edge of this wicker basket, and that's it. And it's just straight down. But anyway, it gave me a chance. I had my camera with me. And normally, even in an airplane, you don't get a perspective, like this bird's eye view looking straight down. And I thought, this is great. I'm going to take some photos going over Des Moines. And what struck me from my experience previously when I was an undergraduate learning urban and regional planning was I saw this and I thought, wow, this is the ideal suburbia culture, because they have these cul-de-sacs, you know, and with the cul-de-sac, you're going to get people kind of stuck in this little circle where you're going to maybe say hi to somebody or maybe bump into their car or something. You know, there's going to be some interaction there in that cul-de-sac. And, you know, some social scientists probably took a design like this one, and in the laboratory, they probably had like little gerbils, you know, and put them in these little boxes, and they saw this is the ideal way to design a community because people are going to interact. You've got the houses facing each other, right? Well, despite good intentions, if you look at the picture, this was taken at a time of day. It was, you know, after the work day, so people should have been home, and it's like a ghost town. And I had lots of pictures like this. I mean, like maybe 100 pictures. Nobody having picnics. Nobody talking to the neighbor, nobody on the front porch. I guess there weren't really front porches, you know. So despite the best intentions of those designing the community, there really wasn't the social interaction. And I think the reason for that goes back to, you know, this 2,000 square foot home. I mean, everything in there, everything you need is there. Get the pizza delivered or the groceries delivered, and you, if you're working from home, which many people do these days with the internet, you could live in there permanently. You wouldn't have to leave unless you wanted to. So that's increasingly what's happening. You know, people are living in these big homes. They're not socializing as much. And to the extent that they are home, if they're going and working the 9 to 5, when you get home, it's, you know, it's into the garage and then into the house, and you're kind of exhausted and maybe watch some TV and have a TV dinner and go to bed, and that's it. That's life. So there's some problems with, I think, having everything under one roof. Despite the benefits, there are some problems. And it's that you really need to be intentional then about socializing, about getting out, because it's not going to happen naturally in this kind of a setting. And a number of studies have been done that show, and this was actually with people who attend church functions, but the thinking is that this would apply to anything. People that have positive, caring social interactions on a regular basis, and that's the kind of experience you often would have. You know, you go to church, people are giving you hugs. Where else do you get a hug? You know, church, right? So, but people who have those kinds of interactions that socialize a lot live longer, have lower rates of illness, recover from illness faster. It's very important to have that social time, you know? So the larger homes, perhaps, are contributing toward maybe a not-so-healthy culture. Well, this is something I call Small Houses 1.0, the first attempt at small houses. This is from, you know, computer software. You say it's the 1.0 version, the 2.0 version. Okay. So these are tiny homes. I took this picture in the early 1980s. It was in 84. I was in Bogota, Colombia, studying urban and regional planning down there. And I was fascinated by these tiny houses that people were living in. So I took a lot of pictures of these houses. And most of them are just, you know, kind of makeshift structures, some tin thrown together and some cardboard and cinder blocks and whatever kind of junk could be found, creating a home. There you go. And when you speak to a city planner and talk about building a home, the first thing they want to know is, what's the size going to be? You know? Because this is what they have in mind. You know, if that house is a small house, it's going to be probably some tin shack you're going to throw up. You know? So most cities, there's a uniform code, actually, that's used in pretty much every city around the United States. And part of that uniform code is that it says, you know, homes must be of a certain size. Homes have to be of a certain size. It's illegal to build a house, I think it's 1,300 square feet or something. Under that, it's illegal. And then there's certainly neighborhood covenants. There's some neighborhoods you'll move in, you'll buy a plot of land, and they'll say, sorry, every house in this neighborhood has to be 3,000 square feet or bigger. And you can only have oak trees and collies. You know, it's whatever laws they make up in these little communities. So, but this is the concern of realtors, of people who own real estate, of the city planners. The concern is we don't want a bunch of little low-budget shacks being thrown up because that just causes property values to plummet and there are other problems. And there you go. There's some places in the United States, actually, that look like this. So I didn't have to travel to South America to find that. So this is the 140-square-foot home that I live in. It looks a lot like a big home. I jokingly, in one of the videos when I was interviewed for a TV thing, I said, standing on the porch, I looked up at it and I said, you know, it looked much bigger in the catalog, you know. So it's 7 by 10. And when I tell people my home is 7 feet by 10 feet, they say, well, that's really small. Wow. But if I told them, you know, I've been renting an efficiency, a room actually, which is easy to find in a college town. I was renting a room for about $260 a month. It was a 10 by 12 room with a nice closet. 10 by 12 room, that doesn't sound bad. That's an average size room. Well, basically what I've done with this house is I've taken that 10 by 12 room and I've created a freestanding efficiency apartment. You don't see that often. And this house kind of raised some, I don't want to say concerns, but raised some eyebrows in the city, in my city, because people were contacting the city and saying, is it legal to have somebody have a house that small? And they said, well, you know, actually, according to, there's a book this thick, if you can imagine. And my dad's a lawyer, so he read through this book for me to explain to me what the city codes were. And he became very concerned as he read through this book. He said, Greg, I think you're violating about, you know, 2,000 codes. I mean, this thing going on and on. I mean, the electrical and the plumbing, and you don't have this and that. He gets to the end of the book, and it's kind of like, you know, remember when the answers used to be in the back of the book? He gets to the end of this book, and it says, you know, if it's an accessory dwelling, if it's like an RV or a camper, you can do whatever you want to do. And he realized, wow, this house is sort of, I don't want to say it's above the law, but it's above the ground. Because it's above the ground, it is kind of above the law, because the laws that apply to a portable dwelling are totally different. And so for that reason, and some other reasons, the city realized, yeah, I guess that's within the law, actually, because I mean, they can't outlaw campers, right? What do you do? So there was a concern, though, that the house was on a yard that faced a street. And so one of the city people came out and said, you know, we do have to have you move that at least, because it can't be in what's considered a front yard. And any yard facing a street is a front yard. So they picked out this location. This is its current location, on the other yard. But it's nice to have somebody from the city who has approved and even picked out the location on the property. Well, the other perplexing thing is that even though, if this were on a foundation, I should say, you know, if this were on a foundation, it would be illegal. What's perplexing about that is that it's bigger than the apartment I was living in. You know, if size dictates whether something is substandard living, then that apartment should have been substandard. In fact, Iowa City, and it's probably the same here, you know, you have students living 3-4 in a dorm room on bunk beds, coming and going at all hours, you know, you're waking up in the middle of the night. I mean, is that substandard? So the cities across the country now are being faced with something called the small house movement. Give me a hand if anyone's heard about the small house movement. A few of you. This house, I guess, it was one of the first in the country that at least got some media attention. And I was called by Cheryl Corley of NPR out of Chicago. She wanted to do an interview. And this was one of the early interviews with the media that I did. And the day that that interview went live on NPR, the website, the Resources for Life website, had 70,000 hits. And that's to let you know, those of you who aren't into the web stuff, that's a big number. Normally it would be like 1,000 would be a good number, or 2,000 a day. So 70,000 hits. And what that told me was, you know, here are these people in their car, in their wherever they were listening to the radio. It's not like they were at their computer, probably. But they heard this story, and this was a few years back. They heard this story, and it compelled them so much that they actually went to the website. And that was the most traffic the website ever saw back then. And back in 2002, when this something called the Small House Society was formed, myself and some other people helped start this Small House Society. If you did a Google search for small house, it would be like doing a search for small elephant. You know, there's no such thing as a small elephant. You know, there's no such thing as a small house. Today, if you do a Google search on small house, you'll see millions, like 200 million results. And the number one link is the Small House Society that was started back in 2002. And there are others out there. So this is a growing movement. I say that. Oh, and I guess another anecdote that's kind of funny. A couple of other news teams came, and it was pretty frequent over a period of months and years. These news teams would come, but it was small, you know, the college TV station or a local affiliate of a national or something like that. And then one day, public television came, and they did a really neat video. And after the crew left, and I have to say, the first crews that came, they had, you know, the video camera with the microphone built in and everything. It was just one camera, and maybe just one person doing the whole thing. And then a few months would go by, and pretty soon it was like the reporter and the camera person. And then finally this public television group came, and they had vans and trucks, and it was, you know, the guy with the sound box separate from the guy with the camera and the lights. And so I kind of got this sense that, wow, this is kind of becoming a big, you know, popular thing. And so they left, and my stepmom sent me this email, and she said, you're going to be famous. I want your autograph. She was joking, you know, and I'm not really into that whole, you know, becoming famous thing anyway, but we were joking about it, and she said, oh, I want your autograph, you know. And so I wrote her back. That was on a Wednesday, and I wrote her back, and I said, no, I'll sign my autograph for you, you know, when Oprah calls. And I was kind of making this joke because David Letterman for a long time said he's waiting for a phone call from Oprah, and she never called. And anyway, 3 days later, and this is just like almost hard to believe, 3 days later, it wasn't Oprah calling, but it was a producer from the Oprah Winfrey Show called. And we had a number of exchanges. They wanted the house to be on their show. We were doing measurements. It turned out the house was too big to get on their set. My sister and I went to the taping of the show anyway. And Jay, the gentleman who he and I worked to build this house, Jay was interviewed by Oprah. So that was kind of the initial pinnacle of this movement, and it's just kind of grown since then. But the fact that, you know, Oprah Winfrey interviewed Jay about these tiny homes, that really propelled this into the public awareness. Okay? So that's all explained to say cities now are having to accommodate for this small house movement. People saying, I want to live in a tiny house like that. So what's happening is cities like in Portland, Oregon, and other places, they're coming up with, I'm just checking the time here, okay. cities are coming up with laws to accommodate smaller homes, what they call cottage communities. So the laws now are transitioning towards smaller living. How am I doing on time, Rick?
You need to wrap up pretty soon, so you have a little bit of time for questions and answers.
Okay, good. I'm going to skip through a couple of these. And this is just a quick comparison. My home is the size of what my bedroom used to be. And all of the rest of this, here's the floor plan, you can see. The sleeping loft is upstairs. Queen-size bed, plenty of room. It's a peaked roof, you know, but you don't sleep standing up, so that's fine. Upstairs. Downstairs is a desk, kitchen, a table that pulls out. And it's a single room that serves the function of many rooms. I mean, that single room can be my study, the kitchen, the dining room, the living room. It can do all that. And here's some pictures from inside the home. The desk there on the left with the table pulled out, seating for two. It's a little tight. And there's the study area. Another picture of that. On the right, you see the kitchen sink with some gravity-fed water containers. And then that metal box on the wall is the heater. It's a heater out of a boat to accommodate the small space. Another picture of the sink. You can see a board that folds down. It's on a hinge. Becomes an extra counter space there in the kitchen area. There's the front door and a clothes closet just inside the front door. So I'm going to wrap up here, but I want to talk about briefly then What's making all this happen? Why is there this great interest? Why is there this small house movement? I think the number one factor, and we can all identify to this, is technology. And in my book, there's a chapter about how technology is shrinking our lives. You know, I have the iPhone here. I carry two because I have two different phone lines. One's business and one's personal. And they're applications that are dedicated applications. So I'll have one application running here and another program running here. But these iPhones are, you know, I can go back to that floor plan. This iPhone is replacing everything that was in the office, everything that was in the living room, everything that was, you know, the books, the videos, the music, the TV shows. Why you don't need a TV setup, you can watch TV shows on your notebook computer or iPhone. So technology is allowing us to live smaller lives comfortably without having to give up too much. And here's some examples of that. And so the principle of new urbanism is something I call outsourcing your home, where the things that you used to have under one roof are now, here's a picture of it, outsourced. So the treadmill that used to be at home is just, it's at the gym. And again, getting back to what I said about those wealthy people, they don't own a treadmill. They're not going to be, you know, getting greasy and fixing that thing. It's broken again, and it's taking a half a day to stay home because the Sears person says, well, it'll be sometime between 1 and 4 and whatever. Nope. They're going to go to the gym. That's what the wealthy people do. And the room that used to be the study, I'll go to the library, or I have my notebook computer. I can go to a coffee shop and work if I want to. Or I can work at home. So these other areas of life, the laundromat is now replacing what used to be the pantry. Why spend $1,200 on a laundry washer dryer set, you know, and then you have to fix it and maintain it? Why not just let somebody else take care of that and give them $2 to do a wash load, you know? So that's the principle of outsourcing your life. And basically, I'll just summarize to say that there are many advantages. You've already kind of seen some of these on the slides I've shown you and talked about some of the principles, but you're going to save time because you have less clutter. Life will become more cost-effective. You'll be reducing the costs of things that you would otherwise own. You can outsource by living smaller. You don't have to live in a tiny home. You could live in a small apartment. You could, in the process of buying a new home, you could say, you know, I'm going to go with the 1,000-square-foot home instead of the 2,000-square-foot home. And you'll end up saving. There are some health benefits. Basically, just having more free time and more money gives you more time to buy healthier, more nutritious food, go to the gym, get more sleep. You don't have to work the second job that's keeping you up late at nights because you're living simpler and way within your means. And the process to becoming small, I explain in the book, and here's some just pointers here. If you have the freedom to do so, to make a quick decision and you say, I'm going to do this, there are storage facilities. But you can take everything you own, put it in a storage facility. I'm not telling you to get rid of it. I'm just saying put it in a storage facility. And what you'll find, if you're able to do this, put everything in storage. It's kind of like what Jesus was asking, give up everything and follow me. Well, no. It's, well, I'll put everything in storage and then do that. So it is hard to give things up entirely. But if, as a first step, you store things, get all the clutter away. Even if you have room at home, you may say, oh, I have room. It's the garage and the basement. Get the clutter out of there. And then go for a few months. How often do you go to the storage facility? Probably not that much. So that stuff you didn't really need. Storage facilities are really inexpensive, $60 a month. You can get like a garage or bigger. And it's much cheaper than paying for a finished home or apartment to have that much space. And you just need storage. You don't need carpeting and drywall. So anyway, that's one of the key points to getting small is put things in storage, see how life is when you're living small. Now, I said that temperance, and I'm equating temperance with restraint, simple living, minimalism, temperance, just doing with less, living simply so that others can simply live. You've probably heard that saying before. I said it was the new black. Well, it's actually the old black. It's been around for a long time, and I've given you some scriptures. Here's a good example in Iowa, the Herbert Hoover home. And I have some pictures of that, which I can share later. But it's a very tiny home. So President of the United States grew up in a small house. And there are many other people who've lived in small homes throughout the years. So it's definitely doable. That's one thing I've tried to do with my life and work is combine kind of an Amish minimalist lifestyle at home with a very high-tech job. That's what I do for the University of Iowa, is working with computers and technology all day. So I'm meshing those two. It's a fusion of those two. And it works well. So I hope that's given you some food for thought and some practical principles that you can start applying in your own life. And hopefully we have time for some good questions here. Thank you. Yes?
What about electricity, gas, and water?
Good question. What about electricity, gas, and water? I'll say that living in a tiny home does not mean having to do without anything, really. My home's a little bit cramped, 10 by 7, but you know, one of these that say 8 by 14, you can have all the amenities in a small space. I wanted to go to the extreme because, and this is explained in the book, growing up, I had some really good experiences going to visit some Amish people that live south of Iowa City in Kelowna. And I thought, hey, that's amazing. You know, as a teenager, I thought, these people live without electricity. How do they do that? You know? And just some other experiences in life where I'd gone on vacation. And while on vacation, some of the best memories that I have were spent staying in cottages and cabins, places without electricity and running water. So I decided to build my home without being hooked up to the power grid and without running water. And I live right next to my parents' home, basically. So if I need facilities, I can go in there. But for the most part, I get up in the morning, I go to the gym. It's my first stop of the day. The fitness center is 2 blocks from work, so I work out, shower, get dressed, go to work. The electric that I do use is just like a boat battery. And I use that in the summertime to run some fans. And those fans, I mentioned that the home is really tight. The fans will pull air through that house, the cool night air. So it's like having air conditioning. So that's in the summer. In the winter, you saw that boat heater doesn't need electricity. It runs off of just a 20-pound tank of gas, LP gas, like you'd run a gas grill. And I really wanted heat that didn't rely on electricity, because you've heard these stories of, you know, 100,000 people without electricity. Well, that means 100,000 people without, like, their furnace working. That's a problem. In Iowa, we have problems like that. And so, anyway, does that answer your question? Yep. Yes? For transportation, good question. I've had cars in the past, but for the last basically 4 or 5 years, I've gone without a car. I just ride the bike, and I live and work within, it's about a 7-minute bike ride. It's real quick. So that works for me. I do have an outside consulting business that I do, computer consulting. So I'll arrive on a job site, somebody's home or at a business, to fix their computers, and I'm on my bicycle. And they know that, and they like that. They're like, oh, that's cool. It's sort of like green computer support or something. Occasionally, I'll take a cab for a trip like this one. I was thinking about biking. No, I wasn't. And so, you know, a trip like this one, I'll rent a car. And it really is freeing, you know, not to have the car, not to have those hassles. So, good question. Yes? When I'm home, which really isn't that often, because my consulting work is, as anyone who does computer consulting, it's like, you know, most people charge $60 to $80 an hour. So every hour I sit at home is like costing me $80 an hour of income I don't earn. But when I'm at home, I'm very close to this main house that's on the property, which is basically in Iowa City. It's right next to the main hospital. So it's right close to the university campus. But it's an old farmhouse. So the old farmhouse is on the property. It's the equivalent of 6 city lots. You could have 6 homes on this property, but there's just the one big house and then my tiny house. And if I want to go inside and use the kitchen or the bathroom or whatever, I'm free to do that. But, you know, being independent as I am, I try to do as much as I can on my own and do what little cooking I do in my tiny house. I have a small cook stove. But most of the time I'm, you know, 9 to 5, 8 to 5 actually, at the University of Iowa. From kind of 5 a.m. to 8 a.m., I'm doing my workout routine and stretches and things like that that I do in the morning. And then in the evening, from, say, 5 to 9, maybe 8, I'm out. I'm billing out my time at $60 to $80 an hour doing this computer consulting. So I don't really sit around home a lot. But, you know, if I were home, that's what I would do. A lot of people who have these tiny homes, they use incinerating or composting toilets, which is a new technology that doesn't require plumbing. And so that's what many people are going with.
Can
Question, yes?
You may have heard the usual trivia question that what is the modern infection that lets yourself unsocialize in our society, of course, the air condition, because people need to sit outside and not come to the socialize in different places. I'm kind of taking that picture for you.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good question. So the question is, I showed a picture of suburbia with people not socializing very much, and then I showed this sort of outsourced life. And the question is, where does the more intimate relationship building go on? Certainly you'll see people at the laundromat or at the gym, but that's not like your best relationships there. But basically, you know, there are increasingly open public spaces, whether it's the park or a coffee shop or a restaurant, where you'll meet with people, connect with people, as if it was your own living room. And you're going to have coffee and sit, and yeah, there's some other people around, but you're focused on them. So that's a high quality connection that you're making with that person. Or going out to dinner. And you'd be surprised with, I should mention the savings, and usually that's a question, how much money are you saving? But I was paying about, say, $1,200 to $1,500 a month in housing and transportation costs. And now the house was paid for, and you know it costs $15,000, basically, the house, so the price of a used car. I don't have any car payments, I don't have any house payments, so that's, you know, say $1,500 a month left over. Well, you can, you know, go out and get a lot of Subway sandwiches for $1,500 or whatever it is you want to do. You really create a huge then gap between your income and your expenses. But to address your question then, the socializing can be done wherever you want, you know. In at least in Iowa City, it works. I should say, if you're out in the middle of Montana or someplace where you don't have a fitness center, you don't have a library, you don't have a coffee shop, you're going to probably want to have those things somewhere, either in your house or increasingly what people are doing is building these community centers. So you have a community center where that's where you go and you cook and you have your exercising and the big screen TV or whatever. In Iowa City, there's an example of this, something called The Lodge. Hundreds of students living in this place called The Lodge. All of those students share the same fitness center. For each level on the building, the students share the same laundry facilities. Inside of an apartment, there are actually four rooms. So the people living in those four rooms share one kitchen, and then two rooms share a single bath. So it's kind of the perfect distribution of amenities and resources for that community of people. Works very well. And people are realizing, you know, I guess everybody doesn't need to have their own washer dryer. You can share that. And there are other things you can share, too. So, another question? Are we getting close to needing to wrap it up? Or?
Yeah, two more.
Okay, yes. Oh, good question. Do I have to pay property tax? Actually, it kind of initially would look like, oh, wait a minute, now you're skirting around the law. You're not paying your taxes for that property. Well, the taxes are paid twice. The taxes are paid on the land, because it's land that's been in our family for a while. My dad pays the taxes on that land. And then I pay taxes on the trailer. There's a sticker. You know, you get your, just like you'd have on your license plate on the car, there's a little license plate on the house and it has a sticker. So I pay taxes on the property itself, on the house itself, and I pay taxes, or indirectly through my dad, paying taxes on the land. So, yes?
Has Abomination contacted you? If too many people do what you're doing, carpenters, plumbers, electricians aren't going to have a job.
They're concerned about that. No, it's a good question. You know, you look at these huge homes, and it reminds me of, if you know what a puffer fish is, it's this fish that'll puff up when it feels threatened. And it's wanting to seem, you know, big. And many of these homes are sort of puffed up. And like that puffer fish, they're sort of full of air. It's just, it's drywall, it's these big rooms, but it's very poorly constructed housing. But the main thing is people want to look big, they want to look successful, so they have the big house. And but part of what's behind all that is, you know, you have all of these different organizations, unions, groups, or whatever, that want to get their share of the construction market. So, you know, if you start talking about homes that don't have electricity, don't have plumbing, don't have masonry work, don't have gutters, some friends of mine have a gutter business, I don't have any gutters, you know, you're putting a lot of people out of work by living simply. But we're kind of seeing now in our nation sort of a turnaround of, getting back to the topic and the title of the talk tonight, temperance being the new black. We're all now, as a nation, experiencing sort of self-imposed temperance and minimalism because of the economic crisis. And we're having to redesign and redefine our lives based on what are our needs and not just what are our wants. And so that is causing a crunch. People are not buying as many big cars or cars at all. People are going with smaller homes, and it's putting people out of business. People that were in these industries that were blooming and blossoming are now dwindling because they're not part of the needs of America necessarily. They were just part of what we used to call wants, and we don't have the funding for the wants. So anyway, I think that you know, we'll do fine. We're going to choose a path of, as a nation, we're going to choose a path of temperance and minimalism and simplicity. But we'll find in that, as an individual and as a nation, that you can have an enjoyable life, an abundant life, a life of quality, but one that's just smaller. So, anyway, thank you for your questions. And I just want to remind you again, I'll be out at a table here selling books and signing if you want to. And go to resourcesforlife.com. I'm going to give you my card if you stop by the table. Resourcesforlife.com. I already have an online community. If you want to go there and ask me more questions, interact with each other, you can do that online. And actually, I plan to have, if it's possible, even some other forums available for more discussion about what's going to be going on tomorrow. So anyway, there's the website. There are these online meetings, as well as interactive. I'm planning on having some seminars online where you can have video and talking. So all of that at resourcesforlife.com. Thanks.